This is Greater LA, the show connecting you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Matt Gillum, in for Steve Giatakis. Two fly fishers are standing under an overpass at the edge of Malibu Creek, admiring the water after a winter of heavy rain. It's deep and shaded. Fallen logs and boulders provide structure. There are bubbles coming to the surface. Oxygen.
I know, I can just imagine them here.
Yeah, I mean, like, off that little, the food would come right there, they'd be stacked right here, and there's a big old boulder in the middle.
The pair agree it's almost perfect habitat for the federally endangered southern steelhead trout. Except there are no southern steelhead here. Invasive species have taken over their waters. And downstream, an old dam, the Ringe Dam, blocks their path to and from the ocean. On this visit, the duo with the fishing poles are looking to reel in invasive species. As reporter Will Callen tells us, it's part of a large restoration effort in the Malibu Creek watershed. The goal? Bring the trout back home.
Hundreds of years ago, before the dam, before the arrival of Europeans, there were plenty of southern steelhead in Malibu Creek. The spotted pink, silver, and olive-colored fish was an important food source for the Chumash Indians.
Especially the roe. We loved the fish. Oh my gosh, to us, that's delicacy. They're full of roe. They're full of fat. They're ready to make that voyage, and they're ready to procreate.
This time of year, David Paul Dominguez's Chumash ancestors would build small, temporary dams near Malibu Lagoon and use them to trap steelhead as they swam upstream to spawn.
Right now is steelhead trout time. So all the bugs that are getting flown out of this creek, it draws in fish. And also they have that migratory DNA in them after maybe 10 generations, they'll still find their way to spawn.
The steelhead has a life cycle like a salmon. It's born in freshwater, spends its life in the ocean, then returns to freshwater to mate. And like a salmon, it's tough, but even tougher. It doesn't have to return to its birthplace, and it doesn't die after reproducing. It can go back to the ocean. The southern steelhead, the type you would find in the Santa Monica Mountains, is especially resilient. It can survive in warmer waters. Still, development has brought some changes the fish just can't adapt to, like barriers that block them from swimming upstream.
That's what we have at Malibu Creek State Park, where we have, a dam. Ringe Dam is just 3 miles upstream, and so that's as far as they can get.
That's Danielle LaFleur, an environmental scientist with California State Parks. This dam, built about 100 years ago, is one reason steelhead numbers dropped in the 20th century. In the late 80s, state biologists documented just a small number below Ringe Dam, but they were cut off from the upper watershed. The section below the dam was considered one of the last steelhead strongholds in the Santa Monicas. Until 1998, Rosie Daggett, a biologist with the Resource Conservation District of the Santa Monica Mountains, was hiking in Topanga and saw some fish in a pool.
I called the National Marine Fisheries guys down in Long Beach, and I said, you got to come up and look at this, because everyone thinks I'm, like a drug-addled hippie in Topanga, and, they're not going to believe that I found a steelhead.
Say what you will about Topanga, Rosie was right about one thing. They were steelhead. Since 2000, she's been monitoring them in the Santa Monica Mountains. At times, it's been demoralizing work, especially in Malibu Creek. At one point, about 6 years ago, Rosie got a call from her team about a struggling female below the dam.
And she was kind of lying on her side and very lethargic. And, when you have a 23-inch steelhead, that is a massively strong fish. And you know how bad it is when she just let me gently pick her up and hold her so that she was facing into the current and getting more oxygen and was just like barely moving her gills. And we're like, oh crap, what do we do now? And while I was holding her, she just stopped moving. It was devastating.
And that was the last steelhead anyone's seen in Malibu Creek. So for scientists today, the question is, can the damage be undone? And if so, how? First of all, the Ringe Dam has to go. The removal would open up 15 more miles of habitat. Maybe surprisingly, it's on its way out. It's a huge logistical challenge. The hardest part might be figuring out what to do with all the sediment that's built up behind the dam in the last century. So it might not happen this decade. But this spring, the State Parks Department began the design and permitting phase. In the meantime, there's a second very important part of the restoration effort, removing invasive species like red swamp crayfish, carp, and largemouth bass, preparing the upper watershed for the return of the steelhead. Which takes us back to the fly fishers on Malibu Creek, under the bridge. They stand at the edge of a deep, cold pool. Woolly seed pods from the cottonwoods drift to the water. Their leader is Debbie Sharpton.
It's a good time to hit, you know, these areas for crayfish and for anything invasive in the water so that we can keep the population low, take advantage of this wonderful winter we had.
If the Ringe Dam went down tomorrow, the steelhead would have to face all those bass, carp, and crayfish, which eat young steelhead and compete for the same food. These fishers are hoping to catch and kill invasive species and document their location so that others can follow their tracks. Debbie, who has a background in land acquisition, has been leading volunteer groups like this one since 2010. A lot of her work targets crayfish. With grants from state parks and other donors, she pays recent college grads to help set up traps and colonize parts of the creek. But for the crayfish, Debbie says they need to do much more than just trapping. For example, they could introduce sterile males into the system.
The crayfish are cannibals, so the big males eat a lot of smaller crayfish.
Debbie knows it won't be easy to keep this up for as long as it takes for the dam to go down. But she's not discouraged.
No, I'm a pretty optimistic person, and I'm very persistent. I don't give up very easily. There's a lot of people working on removing the Ringe Dam.
The fishers end the day with a total of zero fish in the net. But they do haul out a good amount of trash. On May 21st, an even larger group will gather at the pool right above Ringe Dam to see what invasives they can find there. While scientists and conservationists work to get this trout species back into the ecosystem, for David Paul Dominguez of the Santa Ynez Band of Chumash Indians, it's personal. Here's how he describes seeing a steelhead in Malibu almost 10 years ago.
You have goosebumps, man. It's tears. It's you're just to see that prehistoric person still alive, lived during prehistoric times, like ourselves, to see that, that's a and we call them relatives for a reason, because, you know, we have the same justice enforced upon us, whether we would like it or not.
So far this year, only one southern steelhead has been spotted anywhere in Southern California. For KCRW, I'm Will Cowan.
Just ahead for us, we chat with the dean of USC's School of Engineering about AI. Technology has lots of promise, but also seems to be rife with perils. That is coming up on Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now with Greater LA. I'm Matt Gillum. It was back in February that a Microsoft AI chatbot told a reporter it loved him and eventually went full nightmare, saying, quote, "I want to be powerful. I want to be creative. I want to be alive." If you're unsettled by AI and its prospects, you're not alone. The Matrix suddenly seems a lot less sci-fi. But love it or fear it, artificial intelligence is here, and it's going to change our relationship with technology, work, and pretty much everything. USC is positioning itself to be a leader in the emerging field. It opened a new Center for Generative AI and Society in March, and this month, a postdoc researcher at the university was part of a team to snag a $20 million grant to look at applications of AI in education. Joining us to talk about the grant and USC's grand plan for the technology is Yanis Yortsos, Dean of the University's Viterbi School of Engineering. Yanis, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, USC just launched its billion-dollar Frontiers of Computing initiative that's basically going to be campus-wide. Walk us through what it's going to do.
We are going to have essentially three big components. One has to do with creating a computing literacy across all students at the university, whether they're engineering students or students, let's say, in the social sciences, in the arts, in business, and so on and so forth. Given the fact that technology, particularly AI and, you know, new technology, machine learning, are becoming so powerful and also become an integral part of our daily life, will be actually in the not too distant future, we want to make sure our students understand that. So in addition to the technical competence that we want our students to have in this area, we want them to understand also the importance that the ethical decision making that has underlies many of these technologies. So that's one big part of this initiative. The other big part of the initiative is to provide a footprint for expansion of USC technology and engineering and computing on the west side of Los Angeles, where USC has two research institutes, USC Engineering, in fact, the Information Science Institute and the Institute of Creative Technologies, to try to take advantage and also enhance the ecosystem of innovation in this area that happens in Los Angeles. They will culminate also with the creation of a School of Advanced Computing, which will be within the School of Engineering, but it will have extensions and partnerships with the entire university, whether it's in the medical school, at the Keck School of Medicine, whether it's in the Marshall School of Business, at the Dornsife College of Letters, Arts and Sciences, the arts, and so on and so forth. So these three parts constitute what we call frontiers of computing.
Well, you mentioned ethics there. I mean, the CEO of ChatGPT's parent company and other experts appeared before a Senate committee today to discuss the dangers of AI and possible regulations around it. I mean, USC wants to be on the cutting edge of developing the technology. I get that. But what about its possible dangers? How does that factor into the school's calculation as it is building a curriculum?
Absolutely. So we want to make sure that we have a specific programming of a curriculum that addresses precisely the ethics of technology. And that actually even, so within the engineering school, we are creating a new program called Engineering in Society that essentially helps our students understand the role that these technologies are playing for society. Also the way this, and there are two components of this. One is the ethics of how these technologies are put together. For example, if you train, let's say, an AI, what kind of data you use, who owns the data, all the things associated with how this particular AI has been trained. And second, the impact that AI will have in society, whether it is in terms of new jobs that will be created, the way that other jobs will become perhaps obsolete. So we have to figure out what is the right thing for society. And clearly, this is a very much an interdisciplinary aspect that includes not only engineering and technology, but includes political science, it includes social science, it includes policy, it includes business. And USC, I can say, is ideally suited for this, given the fact that it is so interdisciplinary by having so many different schools. And I think we will work together to be able to address this and also revise the curricula in many different ways. So the Center for Generative AI that was mentioned before was created with this particular goal in mind, to be able to understand how education will be affected by AI and what are the new ways by which we can incorporate this into how we educate our students. I think that will have tremendous consequences for the future, and we have to figure out how to incorporate that. These technologies are going very fast. We live in an era in which, the word exponential has been used. I think we're living in an era that actually is faster than exponential, if that's possible. And for the foreseeable future, we have to be able to understand, and try to shape the future in a way that's positive for society and humanity.
Well, okay, before I let you go, I've got to ask. The guy who's considered the godfather of AI, he left his job at Google this month, and he was loudly ringing alarm bells about the technology. We're now in uncharted waters, it seems. Do you think there's a chance that humanity may be engineering its own undoing?
I think that if we understand that AI is essentially nothing more than manipulation of data, and we have the ability of through computing, and the fact that we have such a tremendous amount of computing resources available, to be able to take this data and essentially help us understand maybe new phenomena, maybe understand, by the way, AI is going to be extraordinarily helpful in areas like medicine, because I think the discovery of new pharmaceuticals and discovery of new cures, I think is AI and machine learning are very, very important tools and techniques to help us move in that direction. I think used with good intentions for people that don't have the not rogue actors, and of course you can never exclude rogue actors, they will always be there, but assuming that it's used for useful purposes in a positive way, I think AI can be very, very instrumental in enhancing the good of humanity, including sustainability and many of the other challenges that we have. At the same time, and I think the alarm bells are out there for the misuse of the technology for people that don't have intentions, good intentions, if you like. And I think we have to be careful about this. And that's why I think regulation of AI will become an important part. The same way, I suppose, and this analogy has been said before, you don't have medications given to the populations at large unless they go through clinical trials and be able to be considered safe. And maybe in the future, that will be the same thing as well with AI.
We've been speaking to Yanis Yortsos. He's the dean of the USC Viterbi School of Engineering. Yanis, thanks so much for the conversation.
Thank you.
Back now with more of Greater LA, I'm Matt Gillum. Healthy and affordable food in Los Angeles isn't exactly easy to come by, but one urban farm is helping change that.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy. Oh, baby, because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
On Avenue 33 in Lincoln Heights, Eric Tomasini and Allie Greer have transformed a once weedy, rough, and rugged hillside into a bountiful garden full of fresh vegetables, fruits, and flowers. Their goal is to grow organic produce with and for the surrounding community, all while using regenerative farming practices mindful of the local ecosystem. Eric Tomasini is the co-founder of Avenue 33 Farm and joins us to talk about what they're up to. Hey there, Eric.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you so much for having us.
Well, we're glad to have you here. So I have seen photos of the farm and your produce. It looks delicious. But tell us about what it took to get here. I mean, how much work did you and your wife, Allie, have to put in to make this hillside grow?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. There's a reason for sure that most farmland is on flatland in America. It's really just starting from scratch. We can't really get any machinery up there because of the slope of the hillside. So everything's by hand, mostly using a broad fork, carrying buckets of compost up and down the hill.
Well, I mean, I can imagine there are more than a few challenges to urban farming in LA proper. I mean, what are some of the toughest parts of it?
Yeah, it can be really difficult. It's not necessarily a super developed urban agriculture city in a lot of ways. And so there's not a lot of necessarily like help, whether it be like water or infrastructure in terms of like sales and support from the city. But I think it's also, you know, a city that has a really rich history of agriculture and a lot of people that are connected to agriculture and connected to their food. And so, you know, what it maybe kind of lacks in infrastructure from the city side, it definitely doesn't lack in support from the people of the city.
Well, something that you emphasize is regenerative practices, which has to do with keeping the soil healthy. Tell us a little bit about that and what you plant to do that helps keep the ground sound.
For us, it's really about looking at creating soil health, ecosystem health, plant health, and most importantly, community health. In terms of the soil, really, it's mostly focused on like creating a healthy environment for all of the soil microorganisms that exist there. We use a lot of compost that we make in partnership with Compostable LA, who gives us food scraps. And then we use all the scraps coming off of the farm, make a really rich compost, feed it through our worm bin, and then use that to kind of spread nutrients and microorganisms all over the farm.
You said it's sort of inaccessible, hard to get equipment up there. You're obviously having to irrigate because we are typically a very dry place. How did this winter's parade of storms impact your farm operation?
Yeah, I mean, it was great. It's exactly the winter we're hoping for. I mean, obviously, in a lot of places, it's been pretty destructive. But for our farm, you know, it's really built with rain in mind. Our goal is to capture any rain that falls on the land. And so a lot of our soil practices do a really good job of making that possible. So they increase organic matter, which organic matter is what really allows the soil to like hold moisture. And then it also, because we don't do much disturbance, the soil gets really good structure and has like really good pores, you know, like if you think about a worm moving through soil, it kind of creates these tunnels. And so the water, the soil is really good at letting water infiltrate quickly. So for us, heavy rains are pretty great.
All right. Well, now we've got the farm, we've got the things planted, we've got them growing, we've got them harvested. All that food or a lot of that food goes right back into the surrounding community, right? Talk about how you do that.
So we have kind of two main programs. We have a free food distribution every week, and then we have a farm stand that's open to EBT users where we get market match funding to make that produce affordable. And then we also offer sliding scale farm boxes as well.
Well, Avenue 33 Farm, you mean you guys also partner with a local school to offer programs for students. What are they learning? How are you sort of taking agriculture to kids at school in an urban area?
Yeah, the partnership we have with Los Angeles Leadership Academy has been really great. And actually, the farm stand location is at the school, and the free produce distribution happens there as well. Every week for the free produce distribution, we get a lot of donations, and the students help distributing, packing up the produce, sorting and processing any produce that needs to happen. At that school, we also have a pretty large farm space where we grow food with the students that goes into that free produce distribution. We also work with the faculty to connect kind of like projects on the farm to their school curriculum. And then for the K-8 students, they do a lot of field trips to the farm.
Well, I mean, summer vacation is almost here. Students are going to be taken off. I'm guessing you're going to need a few extra hands around the farm. Are you looking for volunteers, and how do people get involved?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, we do volunteers year-round, and so we have kind of two opportunities for volunteers. One is the free produce distribution, and so they can sign up for that to help pack and process produce and then help distribute it out at the primary school. And then we also have farm volunteer hours, so people can come, help on the farm, help grow the produce, learn about growing using regenerative practices.
Could be a fun summer project for somebody out there. We've been talking to Eric Tomasini. He is the co-founder of Avenue 33 Farm. Eric, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And that is going to do it for today. Tomorrow, grab your doublet and your ruff and raise a flag and a veil. We are going to the Renaissance Pleasure Fair. Our website is kcrw.com/GLA. Head there to give us some feedback on the show. Let us know about stories we should be covering and to get the podcast. Of course, you can also find the podcast at any of the various outlets by searching KCRW Greater LA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Tuck, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bortle all helped put the show together today. I'm Matt Gillum. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great evening.